Stone were available for comment, but Joseph Mayer, private investigator who is representing 18 former members of the temple, says Stone was in the hierarchy of the temple and was instrumental in writing up the material which tried to legalize the illegal act of taking Swinney's property away from him.
We're looking into the People's Temple. Their activities are forgeries, the alleged forgeries, the alleged frauds that were committed upon temple members. We're also looking into the migration of children to Guyana.
Latest chapter in the controversy over the People's Temple in San Francisco. An off-season
continues to grow, and tonight, new charges of bribery and blackmail, and reporter Joe Russon is here in the studio to discuss those very serious allegations. Joe?
Well, many former members have claimed that they suffered beatings and the threats of much worse for leaving the flock of the Reverend Jim Jones, and today Joe Mazur, a private investigator who represents several of the ex-Templeites, played a tape for me, which Mazur says came from Marvin Swinney, a 10-year temple stalwart who left in December of 1975. The bulk of the tape appears to be a phone conversation between Swinney, his wife, and Swinney's mother, a current member. The voice identified and responding as the mother appears to be in a room where others are offering advice and sometimes cheers. At the time of the tape, the Swinneys were trying to get back their 17-year-old boy from the church mission in Guyana. They also had threatened to go to the Attorney General and accused the church of forging a deed granting their home to the church. The voice identified as the mother is urging them to leave the boy and take $2,000 or leave the area with $3,000 and pick up the boy in Guyana. The apparent mother tries a variety of tactics. She warns that the church will release damaging sexual information about the child if Swinney insists on regaining custody. She says the church will attack Swinney himself with signed confessions. She tells them to go east. If you insist on staying here in this vicinity, which I hope to God you don't, you're in for it if you do. An abusive man gets on the line to warn, in gutter language, that of serious consequences if Swinney insists the deed was forged. Later, the mother voice says, if you do harm to this leader, to this cause, we have people like the ones you've talked to deal with. Another voice tries reasoning and then warns, we have people who are ready to die for the sake of peace and harmony. And at another time, the same man tells Swinney that if he pursues his course, you mustn't have any interest in the future. Again and again, Swinney replies calmly, give me back what's mine and there'll be no hassle. I don't want to see anyone hurt. Eventually, Swinney says that he negotiated directly with the Reverend Jim Jones, and his version of the story was related to me this morning by Mazur, his representative, the private detective.
Mr. Swinney said that Jones and he conversed for 2 or 3 hours and haggled over the price, and it was finally raised from $2,000 or $3,000 to $13,000. And Jones agreed to give him $10,000 cash and pay the balance over a period of time.
According to records, former San Francisco and Mendocino County Assistant DA Tim Stone notarized a deed that Swinney says was forged. And according to a tape supplied by Mazur of a phone conversation between Swinney and a man identified as Stone, Stone made the final arrangements on the deal. In this tape, the voice that's identified as Stone says at one point that Father, meaning Reverend Jones, is being unusually generous with Swinney, but he insists that Swinney be packed and ready to leave before he gets any money. Tonight, Charles Gary, who represents the People's Temple, said that he doubted Swinney's story, but he had no detailed information on it. Indeed, Lynn, there's a great deal that we all have to learn about the People's Temple story before we understand the temple or the people who were in it or are in it.
And you're going to stay on that story?
But it's right.
Okay, good, Joe. San Francisco.
This preceding thing has been recorded August 25th from Channel 5, 7 o'clock news. Friday, April 26th, Channel 5, 7 o'clock news.
The farm workers were...
All the lights are on again in Sausalito. PG&E spokesman Mike Johnson.
And Marshall Kilduff from San Francisco Chronicle. These two intrepid reporters will tell us what they've been finding out about the People's Temple. We invited Secretary of the Temple, Gene Brown, and the Temple's lawyer,
Gene Chaykin to come tonight and give their side of the story, but they refused. So we want to hear the Temple side of the story. If you can give us any part of it, if you know anyone who's a member, or if you are a member or have been a member, just please call. Our lines are open at 478-3200. My name is Cheryl James. I'm filling in for Don Chamberlain. And I want to ask Phil Tracy, how did you come by the belief that members of the People's Temple have been ritualistically tortured?
Well, ritualistic torture is not what we've reported.
I thought I read that in one of your articles.
No.
Did I read that in yours, Marshall?
No, it's a strong term,
but it's not quite that bad. We've heard stories about beatings that we think have gone on in the church, according to 20 or 30 people. Phil and I both interviewed separately. Beatings is a tough word for what it is, but we think a fair one. They've, a corporal punishment that's administered to church members voluntarily. I mean, no one forces them to continue going to the temple, but nonetheless, the beatings number up to as many as 125 slaps with a large wooden paddle and boxing matches in which people are pitted against as many as five different opponents for different rounds to be physically overcome.
In the presence of many other church members?
Well, according to the people that we interviewed, they took place in front of the entire church congregation.
500 to 1,000 people.
Right.
One or two nights a week.
But no outsiders. You and I could not see this sort of thing. Well, on these, it might be helpful to start back a ways on this to explain exactly what we're talking about in terms of corporal punishment.
All right, I know. I want to get right into that right away, but I...
Okay.
Why don't we start back at the first? How many actual former members have you talked to?
Well, I've spoken to 35, 36. Phil's talked to, I think, as many.
Yeah.
In each case, we've talked to them separately in pairs and threes, not in one big group.
What was the total number again?
About 36.
Okay.
And we, it'd be one thing if we could only talk to 5 or 10 and had gotten what the temple claims is a kind of screwball quotient, people who've dropped out of a big organization that kind of followed you get in anything. But their stories... these are people who live in Fresno. These are people who live out of state. These are people who've left the church 6 months ago, people who left the church 5 years ago. And their stories...
We've talked to people in South Carolina. I talked to a fellow up in Spokane.
They're old people. They're young people. They're black. They're white. They're fairly wealthy. There's no safe box you can put them in. And the striking similarities in their stories and also the way they just tend to check out is, we think, compelling evidence of the veracity of what they're saying.
Have either of you encountered a former member who says that these things are not true? Or that still have some loyalty to the church?
Who don't deny what we're saying, but they would prefer different words for it. They would prefer, as the temple still does, corporal punishment, discipline, whereas the people we talk to lead us to think that it's a little more malevolent than that, that it's an actual beating. People who still, because they belong to an obsessively a strong-willed organization as such as the temples, still feel a great deal of loyalty to it, and who aren't as quick to divorce themselves. It's a painful process. These people have given up, in some cases, their families, their all the money they have, And in some cases, didn't have much of a life before, and suddenly they became temple members, and they were given a strong direction and a set of chores, and they came in time, the people, at least we're talking about, to have left that, but they've, not everyone has left it entirely.
Okay, Marshall, I see our lines are lighting up, so let's take a call here. Hello, you're on KMBR 68.
Hey.
You're on. You.
Hello. Hi, Cheryl. I'm Kathy. I'm calling from San Francisco.
Hi, Kathy.
Is that right?
Do you have a question about People's Temple?
Yes, I do.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay.
I think you have your radio on, Kathy. Why don't you turn it up?
Yeah, I just turned it
up. Okay, there you go.
Okay. What I wanted to ask about is I watched the news tonight, and I said, I'll stop watch, and I clocked the amount that I considered as actual news that the network showed, and the rest of it I would sort of categorize as either non-news of one kind or another, either some kind of interest story or some very sensationalistic type of
Kathy, are you talking about the People's Temple, or do you have another topic in mind?
Oh, yeah, no, I was calling about the People's Temple.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's
okay.
Definitely a case in point.
Okay.
And as someone who is working in the media, I would like to ask Mr. Kilbert or Mr. Tracy, whichever one would like to address themselves to it, why they feel the newspapers and the media generally is so seems to be so just directed towards centering on this kind of thing. The Elvis Presley funeral, something about a car going into the crowd. This was given front page coverage, and I just like to know what they feel. So
if I understand your question, you're saying that this investigation of the People's Temple seems to be somewhat violent or distasteful.
Well, it seems like it's sort of being, beaten to death, if you'll excuse the pun.
I see.
I think it's kind of, we're getting no end of it. And I wondered if they feel pressured in their writing or something to cater to what they think the public is going to want to hear to what extent.
That's a good question.
I would really like to know.
Let's have both of you respond to that.
Well, the first is that in this particular story, it hardly said the public wanted to hear it. As a matter of fact, we got about 500 letters before we ever sat down and wrote the piece. Were written to our editors telling them that they didn't want us to write the story regardless of what it was going to say. And by and large, I think the woman has a point. I mean, I think the news...
Were there some Temple members whose letters? I mean,
yes, they were. It was part of a campaign in which letters were written. Our advertisers were called...
There were some Temple members.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Excuse me?
What did you say, Kathy?
I mean, I believe it was implied that they were from Temple members. I'm talking about the general public, listening audience. There's thousands of people out, San Francisco.
Well, I think you're right to some extent.
I just wondered, they work, I guess, as a freelance writer, perhaps they're not under so much pressure, and couldn't their investigative talents be employed in uncovering some governmental corruption, some of the things that...
We feel this is a pretty important story, Kathy, because the fact was that the man who ran the church was the head of the city's Housing Authority Commission, and the Temple organization had achieved substantial political power here in San Francisco and was attempting to use that power to further itself through a variety of programs. And the fact was that the kind of public pressure that was put on the magazine, as well as Marshall and myself, came from the a long list of public officials who didn't want the magazine to write about one of their key political supporters and the kind of thing that was going on there. Particularly the beating of young children.
This is the citizen. I certainly wasn't aware of any kind of political power in the Temple. I never heard of it until all this news started, and certainly.
Well, there'd been a campaign against three or four other journalists in town.
Kathy?
It's not really that big a thing, I mean.
Kathy, just a minute, please.
There are a lot of.
Kathy?
Yes?
I'd like to ask Phil. Mm-hmm. If you can explain the political power that you feel that Reverend Jim had that maybe did spur you on a little bit.
If he can?
Spur us on?
Isn't that what you were just explaining?
Well, I mean, the political power that he achieved was through sending out volunteers to work on various political campaigns and helping show up, producing a kind of a roving audience there. Of 300 to 500 mm-hmm. people for various political events that otherwise might be attended by three pigeons, two squirrels, and a local policeman, the efforts of the Tempo in terms of their political power have been fairly clearly established. I mean, they were supporters of Mayor Moscone. They were supporters
I still don't feel that you addressed yourself really to the question that I asked, which is, you know, why newspapers are so bent on giving us sensationalistic kind of reporting and choosing the news, it seems, so that the things that that really would behoove the public to know, you know, in their own interest about
it's pretty sensational news.
It's hard to describe news philosophy or policies of different publications, Kathy, but I think we'll just have to leave it there. We can't really say too much more about it. Thank you for calling. Hello, you're on KNBR 68.
Yes, Cheryl.
Yeah.
My name is Beverly. I live in San Francisco.
Hi, Beverly.
And I wanted to address my question to Mr. Kilda.
Sure.
I never heard your name before all this came out about People's Temple, and it intrigued me, the articles. And I was wondering if this is the general line of story that you have worked on in the past, or what kind of other stories have you worked on? I mean, is this, do you consider yourself an investigative journalist, or is this a regular, you know...
Well, I cover a lot of City Hall.
Chronicle or Examiner or whatever assignment that you have.
It wasn't something I sought out on my very own from the very start. I cover a lot of City Hall commission and board meetings, and my first exposure to Jones was when I covered a housing authority meeting to which he'd just been appointed, and he, as Phil mentioned earlier, began showing up with his roving audience of two or three busloads of older black people who tend to be the bulk of his followers. They didn't seem to be the usual crowd that would show up at these meetings, and it struck me as curious. From there on, my endeavors carried me where I am now.
As a personal assignment, or was it an assignment for the newspaper?
Well, I believe I originally offered it to the newspaper about 6 months ago, and at the time it wasn't thought an avenue worth pursuing. From then on, I went to One magazine, and they eventually, under a lot of pressure, I thought at the start, turned the story down, and I went to a second magazine, this one, San Francisco Magazine, where I had a falling out with the editors on an entirely different account. They were all fired, and I was left standing there holding my stories. Anyway, I went back to New West, and at that point, Phil and I got together, and the story took a stronger shape when we met about a half dozen of these former members, and then came to meet several more.
Have you ever followed a story in depth? This one, I've seen it in the papers for weeks now, and I was wondering if this is your general pattern of really getting down, you know, to the basis of...
Yeah, he never really works that hard. He really doesn't. It's been terrible.
We all have stories we follow time and again. Just as I cover City Hall, I tend to cover the Port Commission every 2 weeks. I mean, there's certain issues, and the Planning Commission, the Redevelopment Agency. We always follow stories. That's why we're given special areas to report on.
Marshall, why did the Chronicle first turn down your offer to investigate the People's Temple story?
Well, it's a funny story, but it has a happy ending. I think my editor, along with dozens of other people in town, was a great admirer of Jim Jones's. And certainly if I'd met Jones under the same circumstances, I probably would have had the same preconceptions. At any rate, he thought Jones, and many other people did, I'm not going to single anyone out on this, that Jones was a very brave social leader, which he indeed appeared to be in many counts. He gave money to the right people, he backed unpopular causes, and we all admire people for that. But I think that the problem was when I began to come up with stuff, the same sort of things that Phil did, the bodyguards, the locked doors of the temple, the kind of secretiveness and the almost mania they have against any kind of press scrutiny, that from that point on, it became very difficult to find a friendly ear because
that my boss, along with many others, believed Jones was still a good guy and that none of these things could be true.
All right, Beverly, does that answer your question?
Yes.
Thank you for calling. We're going to take another call here. Hello, you're on KNBR 68.
Hello?
Hello, this is Cheryl. You're on KNBR 68.
Yeah. I'd like to share an experience.
Okay,
with
what is your name?
People's Temple.
What is your name?
Helen.
Helen? Okay.
Helen, I'm calling from San Francisco.
Okay.
The very minute that we visited the People's Temple, oh, it was about five years ago, I got this eerie feeling that Reverend Jim Jones wasn't really, a true servant. He was sitting there at night with dark glasses, you know, and doing all these fake healings. And
Could you tell they were right
about the whole thing? So I'm
Helen?
A bit surprised, what is coming out now about the People's Temple.
Helen, how could you tell they were fake?
Fake?
Yes.
Because you have the feeling, you know, that it's something that a woman's intuition never fails, I don't think so. And I could just see that these people were planted there at that time already, you know, and he was sitting there asking all these poor people for $100 and $200 and $300 every night. I think that was just awful.
Did it seem strange to you that people actually gave him their money and that people believed that he was their benevolent leader?
I've never seen a church, you know, asking people, really not even asking, almost forcing them to give him $100 or $200 or $300. I couldn't believe it. And the majority of them, of course, were black people. They were all nice people, of course, but I just couldn't believe it, really. And to sit there at night, you know, these services were at night, to sit there with dark glasses, I just didn't feel right about the whole thing.
All right, Helen, thank you for your call. We're going to do a commercial now, and we'll be back with Phil Tracy and Marshall Kilduff on the People's Temple. Bill James, I'm filling in for Don Chamberlain tonight, and I think we're going to take a call here. Good evening, you're on KNBR 68.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi, Cheryl. I'm Beth from San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to ask either Mr. Kilduff or Mr. Tracy if they can comment on what they feel the Bergman Ramirez case means. These were reporters who were, they ran a story apparently in the Examiner, and then they were sued by a corporation that they were exposing, and the Examiner refused to pay their legal fees, you know, wouldn't give them any kind of assistance once they were sued. And I want to know from these two reporters here what defense you have if you get sued for something. What's your recourse for legal defense, and what does this case mean for investigative reporters?
Well, I'm not sure about the way you stated the facts about the Bergman Ramirez case. I think that there was a dispute over the lawyers, and frankly, I don't know all the details. I don't think that it was precisely that the Examiner refused to provide them with legal counsel. And I frankly, I don't know about Marshall. I don't feel really particularly competent to comment on it. In general, the problems of writers, not just restricting it to investigative reporters, but writers in general, facing a constant problem of libel suits, is a very real inhibiting factor in the functioning of the First Amendment. I mean, it's there's two or three more celebrated and direct cases. I mean, there's the La Costa case.
What if you got sued, for instance, with the New West Vacuum Act as far as legal defense?
Yeah, sure. Okay. I mean, we
checked this very quickly.
Right? This was cleared through our libel lawyers. I mean, this any time you've got a serious story like this involving a great deal of controversy, you bring your libel lawyers into the story well before it's published. As I'm sure that the Chronicle or the Examiner did with in the story about the
Well, why do you think they backed out then? They wouldn't give.
Well, as I say, I'm not sure that I want to. I'm not sure that I
I'm not sure the circumstances around it. I know that there are some, there is a dispute there about the question of which attorneys are going to represent them and what defense to take. And frankly, I'm not at liberty to you know, I don't know the details of it that much to say what's right and what's wrong on it.
Oh, it's not routine.
Excuse me.
What was that, Beth? No, I was asking if it's not routine, for instance, to have these stories written by investigators, reporters gone over by libel lawyers in most major newspapers, so investigative reporters would not get into that kind.
Yes, you're right. That is fairly standard.
I think you both agree that you're fairly well protected.
Yeah.
Okay, does that answer your question, Beth?
Well, fairly so. It doesn't really answer my question as far as Bergman and Ramirez are concerned.
Well, they said neither one of them is that familiar with that. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Hello, you're on KNBR 68.
Hello.
Hello, you're on KNBR 68.
Hello, this is Zoanna from Richmond.
Joanna?
Yeah, Zoanna.
Zoanna.
From Richmond.
Hi, Zoanna.
Hi.
Do you have a question for our reporters?
Not really a question. I just want to say thank you to them because they are going into this. People were asking earlier, why do they keep asking this and why do they keep it in the limelight? Well, I'm very grateful because one of my children was one of the children that was beaten. I wasn't in the church, but my child got in the church through her other parent. And I think she's had some kind of emotional damage from this, and I really feel like people ought to be made aware that this sort of thing is going on.
So, Anna, how old is your child?
She's 18 now. She was 16 at the time she was beaten.
Why was she beaten?
For kissing a friend.
For kissing? Kissing is not allowed in the People's Temple?
Kissing a friend, a woman friend, because the woman was a known lesbian.
And someone from the church saw her, and so they beat her?
Yes, and this was her punishment for kissing her friend that she hadn't seen for some time. And I just wanted to say, people say, why are they keeping it in the limelight? Well, I appreciate that they are, because I really want that this man should be exposed, because I've been threatened by them over the years. My daughter was in there for, 6 years. And in fact, three of my children were. And during that time, I was kept in a state of fear for my children and in a state of, just fear for them, for what was going on. And then after they were out, I was threatened on the phone by them because I wrote a letter to the editor about it. It's like I'm not allowed to say how I feel in public. And I finally, when they called and threatened me, I told them, well, I wish they would take it to court and sue me for libel so that I could have all this come out. And now here it is coming out, and I'm glad that it is.
Joanna, thank you very much for the personal, firsthand experience. That's the kind of calls we like to get. It sort of lends validity to what we're talking about tonight. We're going to take another call now. Thank you.
Okay.
Hello, you're on KNBR 68.
Hi, Cheryl. My name is Mike. I'm in San Francisco.
Hi, Mike.
And I'd like to direct this question, I guess, to Mr. Tracy. See, I'm going to start going to school. I am having 1 year school on journalism. And since Mr. Tracy, or at least I believe he is a freelance reporter, I'd like to find out, on the Jim Jones story, how would you go about getting, into this type of a story? How do you get the information
how
freelancers, get their stories?
Okay, are you a freelance reporter, Phil?
No, I'm not.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm a contributing editor to the magazine, and I get involved in the story very reluctantly. It's one of those things. Most of the stories, pieces that I've done over the years that might be terminated, that might be called investigative pieces, are things that fell into them. I don't cover the kind of stuff where I go out looking to do one investigative piece after the next. I'm
It was just the oldest of bad luck
that I stumbled across Marshall Kilbaugh.
Does that answer your question, Mike?
Yeah, and Marshall works for the Chronicle, right?
That's right.
I was just interested in, I think that pretty much answers my question.
Okay, thanks for calling, Mike.
Thank you very much.
Hello, you're on KNBR 68.
Oh, hi, Cheryl. My name is Diane, and I'm calling from San Francisco.
Hello, Diane.
I'd like to ask Mr. Tracy a question.
Okay.
Okay. I was wondering, what other investigative stories have you done, Mr. Tracy?
Well, let's see. I did a piece on the mob's involvement in the Brooklyn waterfront and the governor of the state of New York. I did an investigative piece on another governor of the state of New York and his law firm in Westchester and the people that special interest that he was representing in his law firm at the same time he'd been lieutenant governor for 15 years and taken a salary of $60,000 a year from the people of the state of New York. I did this investigative thing on the Albany Mall and some of the cost overruns in that. I did an investigative piece on, some of the other civil defense program.
And you just fell into all these?
Yeah, right. I'm really unlucky that way. I mean, you stumble across these things, and, for one reason or another, nobody's written them or nobody's looked them up or nobody's, wanted to cope with them. And
can one make a reasonable living as a freelance journalist?
Hell no.
You don't think so, huh?
Is that what you want to do, Diane?
I was considering it, yeah.
Knitting. I'm telling you, hanging wallpaper, cleaning streets, walking dogs, almost anything can be made more money than from freelance journalism.
But don't you start by freelancing and then hopefully get on with the magazine?
Yes, there's a gap there for about 3 years where if you can somehow manage to live on nothing, you're deemed then sufficiently capable of going on and moving into regular journalism.
Okay, Diane, I think we want to get back to the People's Temple. Did you have a question about that?
No, Mr. Case is answering.
Okay, thank you for calling. Thank you for calling. Hello, you're on KNBR 68.
Hi, Phil. My name is Robin.
Hi, Robin.
And I'd like to direct my question to Mr. Tracy.
Okay.
Okay, we're ready.
How do you go about, getting an assignment? Like, does someone, tell you what to write? Because you are a freelance writer. Or do you, just pick out your own subject?
They care more about you being a freelance writer.
Well, it's wonderful. I think it's just grand.